to share each lovely day. And through the years, those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
It's Good News Week. Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Listen to Writers on Writing every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 88.9 FM. KUCI in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus in Southern California. We're also on the web at kuci.org and we broadcast on iTunes at Public Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett and welcome. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today we have a fabulous show. We have Mireille Giuliano, author of French Women Don't Get Fat, and we have Theo Pauline Nestor, author of How to Sleep Alone in a King-Size Bed, a memoir. First up is Mireille Giuliano. Let's bring her on. Hi there.
Good morning, Barbara. How are you?
Great. Great to have you on. I have been aware of your book, French Women Don't Get Fat, for some time. It's been out for a couple of years, and it has become a raging success, almost from the start, actually. Could you talk about the book and how it came to be?
Well, I had the book in my head for the last 20 years, but I never wanted to write a book because, one, I didn't have the time, and two, I was not a writer. And so when people asked me to put down my tips and tricks to be in shape, consider my job, which was, you know, heavy and entertaining, cooking, going out, eating, I always shrugged and said, well, you know, French women don't get fat, but I'm out of this. And then meanwhile, I helped friends and colleagues, and to make a long story short, it's always being at the right place at the right time, and through a friend whose wife I'd helped and who had connection with the publishing world, he dropped a note to someone he knew in as an agent, and she loved my ideas and thought that there would be no problem and find a publisher in a matter of 2 months. And before I could say no, here I was with a contract to write a book and, in addition to a full-time job. So it was kind of happening very fast. And And then the book came out, and it happened even faster because within 2 months it was on major books bestseller lists, from the New York Times to LA Times to many, many others, USA Today, Wall Street, etc. And then also it caught the attention of other countries, and within 2-3 months we had like over 20 countries who bought the rights. So it escalated at such a speed that I was like, you know, on cloud nine and trying to face the book, my life, my work, the travel. And here we are, you know, three and almost 4 years later. It just came out in paperback in January. And it's still not stopping. You know, there's not a week where I don't have interviews. I was in Paris last week and I had a Korean TV doing a program on my book and my philosophy. This morning I was interviewed by a business magazine feature journalist. It goes on, and of course I do a lot of email Q&As and radio interviews, and it shows that it's something that has become, as you said, the title and the notion that we need to take care of our body and pay attention to what we eat is something that is important. It's not going to go away. So my little book is, you know, common sense, but getting attention, because it's not a diet and it's something that one doesn't have to actually be French, live in France to do it. You can apply it wherever you live.
Now, it sounds like you had the title right from the start. Is that so?
Yes, the title actually came from, you know, when I was lecturing in America. Actually, it's a book really that I dedicate to my American friends, women friends, because it's thanks to them. When I was lecturing on gastronomy and wine for Veuve Clicquot, the champagne company I worked for, and whether I was in Chicago or San Francisco or Dallas or Miami, at the end of my talk, the questions, after the Q&A, actually, you know, when I was about to leave, some women would come to me and said, you know, I have a question. You're so passionate about what you do, and you love food and wine, and you eat in restaurants, you love to cook, and we see you in magazines, entertaining, and how come you're not fat? And I couldn't say I've been there, done that. So, you know, having been brought up French, my mother said, don't ever tell your life to strangers. So with my polite little French way, I didn't know what to say and to admit that I was once fat. And so I would, you know, give them the French shrug and said, you know, with a smile, well, you know, French women don't get fat. And so that kind of became a teaser, because, you know, I would come back the next year and they would say, well, you know, but what do they do? What are their tricks? And I said, well, we have a few tips. And, oh, you should write a book. You should write a book. And I kept saying, no, I don't want to write a book for all the reasons I said before. And then, you know, one day a good friend of mine, she's actually teaching French at Berkeley, an American woman from New York who moved to Berkeley, said to me, you know, Mireille, you've helped colleagues, you helped friends, it always worked. You really have to write this book. And I said, but why? I don't, you know, I don't need to write a book to feel fulfilled. And she said, even if you save 5 women's lives, you have to do it. And I think that was the ah moment, like, oh, mm-hmm. I can make a little difference, you know.
Sure.
And I think of it every day, because, you know, I could retire and, you know, go to the beach every day or be on vacation. And I'm like, you know, almost obsessed by this mission of making a tiny difference and helping women out there. Because through my travel and through then the second book, I realized that there's so many desperate women out there who have tried all the diets, who don't know how to juggle, you know, work and life balance and all that. And so my little message, you know, especially because they are filled with stories and humor and anecdotes, and can help motivate, inspire, or, as so many women write me every day, change their lives. So
yeah.
Here I am.
Yeah.
I'm doing my quiet French revolution in a small way.
Oh, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm on with Mireille Giuliano, author of French Women Don't Get Fat, The Secret of Eating for Pleasure, now in paperback by Vintage. I loved reading this book. Years ago, I would read all the diet books, and then I pretty much stopped because they very much were all the same. And just sort of, you know, slight variances, but pretty much all the same. One thing I loved about your book is the voice, and that it's a piece of lovely, entertaining writing as well. You have a lovely voice, and can you talk a little bit about that? About you know, because it sounds like you didn't start out as a writer. How you got your voice in mm-hmm. here, and I think that's really. It has to be one of the, I mean, the premise of the book is solid, but also the voice and the fact that in reading it, you feel like you're, you know, being talked to personally. It's a conversational voice. It's, mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. very lovely. Talk about that a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, thank you. But, you know, it is funny in a way because, as you said, you know, I didn't train as a writer and I didn't take journalism or anything like that, but I did start with a love of words, starting with, you know, reading. I mean, when I grew up, I came from a modest family, and the gifts for Christmas or birthdays were always books. And, you know, my father taught me how to read when I was four, and we always had a love for words and books. And then, of course, at university, at the Sorbonne, I had a degree in literature, so I loved the words, but then, of course, came reality, and I had to pay my rent, and I got a job in business. And luckily, I did something I loved for all my life, but it's interesting that here it is, you know, and I always tell people I have my third act was given to me on a silver platter, and it's this book, this little book, which has become my third act, you know. And I love, and my husband is you know, proven, encouraged me all the time, because he always thought I was a good storyteller. And when I, you know, got this contract to write the book, and I said, but I'm not a writer, and he said, but you can tell stories, all these stories that you tell me, just put them on paper. And I was amazed how it came out so easily, because as my friends who read the book say, you know, we feel like we have a conversation with you. It's not like I had to write a novel and struggle for, you know, 3 hours on a particular word. It was just my life and my stories, and they were easy to tell.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah, interesting. It feels that way, but it definitely feels crafted. The book is crafted, and you know, I found myself just giggling, and which is a nice thing to do when you're reading a diet book.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's why we call it, you know, it's the press called it the ultimate non-diet book, because as you said before, diet book, first of all, they're boring. They're all the same. They repeat each other and they copy each other, and they are torture. You know, diets are torture, and you have to, you know, they're very prescriptive. Do this, don't do that. Eat this, don't eat that. And my book is not at all that. It's like, no, you can have everything. You just have to have a little plan, you know. And it's actually a lifestyle approach, a philosophy that is the French philosophy still today. I mean, you know, I go back and forth all the time, and sure, now with globalization, I mean, there are fat people everywhere, unfortunately, more and more, but the typical French woman still do, you know. I laughed at Christmas because here we were, you know, on January 1st, and one of my young friends said, oh, I've got to do the leek soup. And I said, mm-hmm. What do you mean? And she hadn't read my book, you know, but she said, well, you know, we have Epiphany in a few days with these wonderful galettes, and I've eaten too much over Christmas and New Year. So here she was, you know, 28 years old, and she does the leek broth, but nobody talks about it or tell it. You know, French women are very secretive and don't like to share. That's why, you know, when the book came out in France, it was like, which was a surprise to me, and it was even a bestseller, which is even more of a surprise, but it came out for other reasons, but when it came out, several of my friends said, but why did you reveal all our secrets? And to me, it was like, well, you know, it's worth sharing, because if it works, why not help other women all over the globe?
And yes, yes. Well, I'm glad you shared your secrets. We're talking with Mireille Giuliano, author of French Women Don't Get Fat. One of the little pieces I loved in here was how you say French women don't go to the gym. They move around, they walk,
yes.
Because I live in Southern California, and here the gym is very much a part of so many women's lives, and I've always hated the gym. I think I belonged once for a few months, but I have felt guilty that I don't want to go, and then I read that in your book, and I had permission to not like going to the gym and to not go.
Yes.
But you talk a lot about just movement. And,
well, because, you know, in many ways, French women are very frugal. So we always find a way, whether when we cook, you know, we like to make three meals out of one. We always have, when we shop, you know, people, when I was in Shanghai, young women asked me what was the name of the designers of the piece of what I was wearing. And I felt like saying, well, you're going to be surprised, young ladies, because we don't wear design couture, you know. It's like, it's all these myths, but basically the French woman loves to have her little tips and tricks and to do things, you know. And so, you know, the joke about my French friends when they come to New York, actually from my New York apartment, I see this gym at the corner of the West Village, and you know, and they look at all these people on the treadmill, you know, at 7 in the morning and at, you know, from 6 to 8 and 9 at night. And my friend Sylvie was like, what's that? And I said, well, it's a gym club. She said, well, gym? And why do people go to the gym in a wonderful city like that where you can walk? And I said, well, you know. And she said, but how does it work? So I told them, I said, I don't know, but, you know, it's quite expensive. She said, you mean, and you have to pay for this? You mean, it's a torture.
Right. You have to pay to be tortured.
Yes. The contradiction for French people, you know. Walking is the most, first of all, it's the best type of exercise, but it's also, you know, you can do it when you want, where you want, for how long you want, in street clothes. And it does more than, you know, change your waist to your feet. It does a lot psychologically to your head. And, you know, you're out, you breathe, you can dream, you can plan your day, you can, I mean, it's so positive, you know, and it's free.
Yes, and it's free. One of the things people, or I hear women saying when I bring up the book is, now, how can you eat chocolate? You can't eat chocolate when you're losing weight.
Yes, you can, of course.
Or French bread.
I mean, French women eat chocolate. I mean, you know, the amount of French women who eat chocolate every day is staggering. Because chocolate, of course, if you eat a slab, you're going to gain weight because it has calories. But chocolate is one of the best antioxidants. It has the right fibers, the right fat. And, you know, in my book, especially in the second one where I continue what I couldn't say in the first one because of lack of space, chocolate is very good for you. And all you need is, you know, it's all eating with your senses, and the three bites count. And when you learn that, you learn to be satisfied with a little square of chocolate. Mm-hmm. Because after that, it's just, not, you know.
Yeah, well, I think one thing that we miss, especially with all the plethora of diet books, is the fact that it's a whole lifestyle change, which comes across in your book.
Yes, that, definitely. It's you know, eating with your senses and eating sitting down, not multitasking. It's all against the 21st century traps, and people think that, you know, they can't. I just had an interview, and the woman said, you know, in the office, nobody goes out for lunch. They sit at their desk, and while they do their email or whatever, they eat. Well, that's not eating. That's not living. You know, so you're kind of autopilot. And when you do that, by the way, because your stomach needs 20 minutes to tell your brain that you've had enough, when you eat in 3, 5, 12, 19 minutes, it's like wasted. Wasted calories, wasted everything, because you're not telling your body, your body doesn't have the time to tell your brain that you have enough. So what do? You eat more. And when you eat more, you get fat. And if on top of it you eat prepared food, which are loaded in salt and sugar and fat, you gain more weight and you eat more.
Yes.
It's a vicious circle. So, you know, you have a few tips to start easy, and then you add up. And, you know, I have women who've lost, you know, 5, 10, 15 pounds just drinking more water, going for walks, eating soups, and reducing their bread or whatever their offender is. And you don't have to deprive you anything.
Mm-hmm. Will you read from your book, take a few minutes and read a couple pages?
Sure.
Okay. And if you just tuned in, we are listening, you are listening to Writers on Writing, and we're here today with Marae Giuliano, author of French Women Don't Get Fat, The Secret of Eating for Pleasure, published by Vintage.
Okay, well, I'll read you a little passage from the end that will give you, the readers who haven't read it, some idea of what it's about. I won't read the whole list, but I'll read some.
Okay.
And it starts, it would be contrary to French sensibilities to attempt to summarize or reduce a whole philosophy to a set of discrete principles. Any real design for living is more than the sum of its parts. But I am an American, too. And being a CEO, I have a particular weakness for bullets and PowerPoints. Besides, what book could call itself French if it didn't at least flirt with deconstructing itself? So with careful appreciation for the slipperiness of generalizations, the American in me feels compelled to observe that French women typically think about good things to eat. American women typically worry about bad things to eat. French women eat smaller portions of more things. American women eat larger portions of fewer things. French women love bread and would never consider a life without carbs. French women don't eat fat-free, sugar-free, or anything artificially stripped of natural flavor. They go for the real thing in moderation. French women eat with all five senses, allowing less to seem like more. French women do stray, but they always come back, believing they are only detours and no dead ends. French women honor mealtime rituals and don't eat standing up or on the run or in front of the TV. French women don't have much TV. French women don't have much TV to watch. French women will dress to take out the garbage. You never know. French women know l'amour fait maigrir, love is slimming. French women avoid anything that demands too much effort for too little pleasure. French women love to sit at a cafe and do nothing but enjoy the moment. French women love to laugh. French women eat for pleasure. French women don't diet, and French women don't get fat. In the end, the only thing really dividing French and American women is inertia. For there is absolutely no French trick or custom that you can make your own. With a little common sense and attention to your individual needs, strengths and weaknesses, and pleasures.
Thank you very much. That was Marae Giuliano reading from French Women Don't Get Fat, a lovely, lovely book about food, lifestyle, and getting healthy. I love so much of course the French words throughout here, phrases, and the books that and the art that streams through the book. It's such a nice book. And you love yogurt.
Thank you.
So yogurt is an important ingredient to health and diet.
Excuse me?
Yogurt?
My book.
Yogurt.
Yogurt, sorry, I can't hear you very well.
That's okay.
Yogurt is actually one of the greatest tricks of French women because, you know, yogurt actually burns fat cells. And the real yogurt, meaning the one with, you know, yogurt is only milk and culture. And there's a lot of what I call poison yogurts out there with corn syrup and artificial flavor and jam and all that thing. And if you have the real yogurt and you eat two portions, which is 2.5 cups a day, you can lose like 10 pounds of body fat in a year because it's one of the best ingredients. And it's a perfect, you know, breakfast because it has mostly protein, a little carb, a little fat, which is very intentional in the French lifestyle approach. You know, you don't do a no carb or no protein or no this, no that. You need a little bit of each. Your body needs a little bit of each. So yogurt is great for breakfast. It's a great snack if you need one. And we also use it a lot, you know, in cooking with dishes like chicken, the Mediterranean-type yogurt. And, you know, when my book came out, actually, the yogurt maker got out of stock for a while because women realized that you can make yogurt for the whole week, you know, 6 or 8 for the price of one, because all you have to buy is a quart of milk, and the machine does the work. And actually, I have a little video on my website to show you how to do it.
Oh,
it's
and give
really
your website address.
It's wonderful.
Give your website address.
Yeah?
What is your website address?
Yes, the website is www.mireillejuliano.com, and it's at the end of the book, it's mentioned, and my name is spelled, as you know, MireilleJuliano. But if you type French woman, don't get fat, you'll get it as well.
Yes. Well, I have appreciated speaking with you, and thank you so much for writing your book.
Well, thank you for having me, Barbara, and I miss California, so next time we'll have lunch and yogurt.
That would be wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was Mireille Juliano speaking to us from New York City. French Women Don't Get Fat is her book, a wonderful book, and very pretty blue. And now we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be back with another author of a very pretty blue book and a very wonderful memoir called How to Sleep Alone in a King-Size Bed. So stay with us. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Stations playing them, ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Love, Peace, and Genocide, a week-long commemoration raising awareness about the Armenian Genocide through performance art. From Monday, April 21st through Thursday, April 24th, a collaboration of UC Irvine clubs welcome you to come out and participate. Look for us each day on UCI's Ring Road from 12 to 1. For more information, email lovepeaceandgenocide@hotmail.com. Come join us and celebrate a movement forward into preventing denial and genocides in the future.
The dirt on publishing, writers, authors, all of it. Listen.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello again, and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're also online at kuci.org, and we are broadcast via iTunes. You go to iTunes, you go to radio, scan down to public, and you'll find KUCI FM right there. We also podcast the show. This one will go up in a couple of weeks, as do they all. What you want to do is go to my website, which is penonfire.com. Click on the radio page. You'll see a radio tower on the left side of the screen. It'll take you to the radio page, and at the top of the page, you will find instructions on how to listen to the podcast. 200 plus, probably 300 at this point, shows up any time of the day, free of charge. You can listen to many shows that have been broadcast over the past 10 years. I'm here now with Theo Pauline Nestor. She's author of How to Sleep Alone in a King-Size Bed, published by Crown. Another blue book, French Women Don't Get Fat, is a beautiful blue book. This is another beautiful blue book. She teaches writing at the University of Washington. Her essay, The Chickens in the Oven, My Husband's Out the Door, was published in the New York Times Modern Love column and was the genesis of this book. She lives in Seattle. Let's bring her on. Hi, Theo.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on. Talk about how the book came to be. In your bio, we talk about The Chickens in the Oven, My Husband's Out the Door, your essay that was in the New York Times. Is that what propelled you to write this book? Was the book in the works? Talk about that.
Well, I had been working on another book about motherhood, and it was actually really bad timing in my, you know, budding career as a writer. I wrote a book about motherhood, and it was being sent out right as my husband and I split up. And I was sort of, you know, hoping that the book, you know, even though my marriage was ending, the book would get published. But unfortunately, it never found a publisher. So these two things were crashing and burning at the same time. And I thought, well, you know, I'll keep working on that book, I'll make it better, but I just lost all enthusiasm for writing anything, except sort of scribbling stuff down about my divorce. And I just was, you know, really not thinking it was going to head anywhere, but I started writing this long piece about divorce. And I went to the Breadloaf Writers Conference, and I workshopped it with Ted Conover when I was there. And at the end of the conference, he emailed me and he said, a neighbor, a friend of mine is starting a column for the New York Times, and I think what you're writing would be a good match for it. So Dan Jones, who's the editor of the column, actually looked at this longer work and helped me extract the shorter 1,600-word essay. And then I just kept writing, and then eventually I realized, okay, I am writing a book about my divorce. Whether I want to be or not, I was.
Well, that's interesting, whether you want to be or not, because sometimes it just seems that the work, sometimes the best work is that which calls us to it versus us trying to force ourselves to go in a certain direction, either because of marketplace or because other people think we should.
Right. Yes, I was actually in the beginning trying to force the book to be something a little bit different, too. I didn't really want to write about my own divorce. I mean, I could see that there was a lot of problems with doing that, that I would be exposing myself and my family. And I thought the more compelling story was a sub-story that's in the book, which is my parents' divorce and my sister's subsequent move to Mexico with my father. And I thought it would be this, like, sort of intellectual story about how my sister grew up speaking Spanish and I spoke English and language and Noam Chomsky. And I was trying to write this really smart book, maybe because my first book wasn't getting published. I thought I had to be smarter than I am. And it was the slowest go. And then when I just let myself write about this this real story of what happened to me, it was much easier to write.
Mm. How was that, though? You have so many personal things in the book and so many emotional moments. Were you thinking at all when you were writing it? How
Barbara, I have to tell you that for some reason this connection is as if you're underwater. So I can only. Is there any way it can be a bit clearer?
I don't know. I can speak up. Is that better?
I try talking now. It's a bit scratchy. Or
something. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you sound fine. So if you can make out anything I'm saying, I think we'll be okay.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Talk about, though, writing in such a personal way about other people, your ex, your kids, your mother, and whether you thought about that at the time or did you just figure you would deal with it later after the book was done?
I thought about it a lot during the writing of the book because there are several things that come up during the book that I knew would be, that were intensely personal and might upset other people that they were being exposed in that way. But I also felt like I didn't really have a choice, like this was the story that I needed to tell. And so it was, you know, it was constantly sort of a concern, like, what's my mother going to say? How is my ex-husband going to react? Am I a good mother if I write about the personal moments of our family that expose private moments of my daughter's lives? So it's kind of a weird dualism. Like, that conflict was there, and it was going on, but at the same time, I was still just writing the story I had to write.
And then afterward, did you allow anyone to vet it? Did you give it to your ex or to your mom or read them portions and say, what do you think? Or how did you deal with that?
So with my ex-husband, he's pretty much chosen, like he doesn't want to read the book and he really just doesn't want to know it. You know, he's not that happy about the fact that I've written this book. But I told him sort of the extent of how he's involved, and I described it to him. And I described his scenes to him, and I sort of said, well, these are your scenes, and this is when you're in the book. And he said, you know, he said that was okay. And when I wrote the New York Times essay, I had him read that before they published it. Now, with my mom, what I did was when I was editing the book with the editor, I had her read a draft then. And there were a few things that she asked me to change. She asked me to change my parents' business, and I won't say what it actually is, to protect privacy of some of the people involved in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So my parents owned a business, and I say in the book it's a construction business, but it was something else. And she also asked me to change her first name and the name of my father.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I said at the beginning of the book, you know, I have an author's note, and I say, you know, I had to change a few identifying details to protect the privacy of other people's stories that are bound up with mine. I can't really tell my story without telling parts of theirs, but they want to keep some of their identity and life private.
Sure. Interesting. Okay. It'd be great to have you read from your book at this point. Would you do that?
Sure.
Okay, and if you just tuned in, you're a little bit late, but we have a few minutes left with Theo Pauline Nestor, who wrote How to Sleep Alone in a King-Size Bed, a memoir published by Crown. Okay.
Great. So this section that I'm reading is from Chapter 6, which is called Welcome to Divorce 101. And just sort of some background to know about this section is one of the themes of the book is the fact that I'm not only divorcing as a grown-up, but I'm also a child of divorce because my parents divorced when I was a baby.
Okay.
For a long time, I've been aware of the crucial differences between the people I call the rule followers and lackadaisical people like me. And tonight, here at the annual Girl Scout Cookie Kickoff meeting, I wonder, does it really happen to them? They say it can happen to anyone, but is that actually true? Surely these incredibly sensible women, the women who would never dream of buying a laptop on impulse, who really do shop around for the lowest price on car insurance, who majored in biology or earth sciences, who measure dry ingredients when baking and actually own the metal spatula utensil used to level off the heaping cup of flour, surely they are immune to some of this divorce misery. If they are not immune, I can't believe that their odds aren't quite favorable of picking a mate with a similar passion for recycling, CPR training, and driving within the speed limit. These women think things through. They do not spend money all December and then bicker all the way through January. They have Christmas savings accounts. My mind has been locked up in just this sort of twisted thinking the last past few weeks. Well, more specifically, I've been engaging in a struggle between this incessant habit of comparing myself to others and the knowledge that to do so is insanely rational, and that struggle and suffering are part of the universal experience, even if the struggle of others isn't always evident to me. Similarly, my brain has hosted a war between a faction that insists that marriage is a doomed institution to which no one is truly suited, and a hostile tribe that is adamant that the true problem resides in my innate inability to grasp the laws of cause and effect. That if only I'd majored in accounting, if only I were one of the rules people, I wouldn't be divorced and unemployed at this age. This habit of comparing myself with others has dogged me all my life. As a kid, I was obsessed with the ease with which certain kids seemed to sail through their days. Why was I forever falling off my bike and losing my homework? How were other kids staying on their bikes? What was keeping them there? I remember in the 11th grade, I set my friend Kathy Webster down, and I said, "How do you do it? How do you make everything look so easy?" She had long, straight blonde hair, and the members of her family were named in descending alphabetical order, from oldest daughter, Anita, to middle daughter, Barbie, and then the youngest, Kathy. Like most of the families in our uber-Anglican neighborhood, their family tree had no severed limbs. No divorces had divided their loyalties or their attention. But as smart as Kathy was, she had no idea what I was talking about, even though I explained my entire neurosis ad nauseum. "Okay," I said finally, "just tell me, how is it you get straight A's? Like in Mr. Cowell's social studies class, how is it I'm always getting C pluses on the essays and you're always getting A's?" "Well, that's easy," she said. "I just write exactly what he says in class, the same words and everything. I just feed it right back to him." I sat there dumbfounded for a minute. "You mean, like, you can actually hear what he says?" Earlier that month, we'd been assigned to All Quiet on the Western Front. I'd actually read the book, which I thought was commendable, but I had no idea what Mr. Callow had said about it. To me, he sounded like the teacher in the Peanuts special. Wah, wah, wah. "Well, of course, can't you?" she asked. "No, I can't," I said. And I realized then that I hadn't heard any of my teachers in years. It was like I was swimming underwater during class, hearing nothing but the muffled roar of the voices above and the deafening sound of my own thoughts. I guess that was the difference between kids like Kathy and me. I was so busy wondering whether I was okay that I couldn't attend to the world around me. While Kathy, she just knew she was okay, and that she was the C of A, B, and C.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That was Theo Pauline Nestor reading from How to Sleep Alone in a King-Size Bed, published by Crown. I will say, it's interesting. The memoir is about divorce and picking up the pieces, but it's not typically a topic I'm drawn to. But I received your book, and I opened it up, and I, as I always do with books that come in the mail, I read, I think, the first paragraph, and I loved your writing. And I just decided then, I didn't really care what it was about. I just wanted to read it because I liked your writing so much.
Great.
Talk about that. Talk about voice and craft. And is this, I mean, do you write the way you talk? How did you get How did you get it in here, the voice, the lovely voice of the book?
Well, one thing is, I've been writing for a really long time. I mean, I started writing, a little bit in college. I'm 46 now, and I started writing in college, and then, I never liked anything I wrote, so it was on and off. But I started really writing when I was 33. Actually, right when my first daughter was born, I started really putting a lot of energy into writing, and I've been writing steadily for 10 years before I wrote this book. And I think that one of the things that was hard for me to understand as a beginning writer is that writing is a long apprenticeship, and it does take a long time to find the voice that is yours. And unfortunately, I actually don't talk as well as I write. I mean, I wish I could talk like I write. But one of the reasons that, the writing is better than the talking is that there's a lot of revision. And when you talk, it's just one shot, right? Like, it just comes out and there it is. But I did revise. I write very slowly. I don't, a lot of writers, 1,000 words a day or more. And I'm not like that. I write slowly, and it has to be just the way I like it, or I can't move on to the next section. So I think that's part of it, just the fact that I stayed with it for a long time. And I also had a writing teacher who really encouraged me to just be my weird, quirky, just true self on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, he's got a book that's doing really well right now. His name is David Shields, and he has a book called The Thing About Life Is One Day You'll Be Dead,
mm-hmm.
which is a really quirky book, and everything David writes is quirky. And just having this professor say, yeah, be that person that you are, really empowered me and helped me to find, okay, this is the way I want to say all these things on the page.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great, because I think one thing writers do, especially beginning writers do, is try not to sound like themselves, thinking that their voice is not all that interesting, and what they have to do is write like a writer.
But I think that's really okay to go through that stage. I actually think that every artist of every type of medium goes through an imitation stage. Like, I remember I actually had the stage where I wanted to be Amy Hampel, who mm-hmm. wrote, I don't know if you know the short story, In the Cemetery Where Al Jolson is Buried.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And, I mean, the thing is, only she can be Amy Hampel. I mean, there's only one, and that's true for most writers. But I wanted to be this sort of, like, cool, edgy writer like her. And I wrote a lot of bad short stories trying to be like that. I wasn't admitting it to myself at the time, but it's true. And I've talked to a lot of writers, and I think it's a stage that you have to go through. You hear a voice or two or three out there, and you're like, there's something in that. That's like what I want to be. And then you try following that, and I think it actually can often take you into your real self. It's a bit of a detour, but I think it's a common developmental stage in becoming a writer.
Mm. Will you talk a minute about your essay, which I read, seemed to me to be, it's a wonderful essay in the New York Times, and seemed to be a condensed version of your book.
Right.
And, it's almost like you could spread out the essay, fill in the gaps, and there's your book.
Yes.
Will you talk about that?
Well, I mean, I think that was a little bit of the problem I had in starting to write the book, because I think part of me, it's natural for me to do the essay form, and I really like moving quickly from one time frame to the next, and you're right, like the essay that I wrote that was in the Times, it covers a lot of different time frames and topics that had to do with the aftermath of divorce, like telling other people, the sort of ennui and depression and starting life over. And I that was a problem for me, because I realized when I was telling the when I was writing the book, I couldn't move through time frames that quickly, because then I wouldn't have a book. I would, you know, I would move through the whole thing. So I had to teach myself how to tell the story more slowly, but still be able to write in the kind of a dense way that I like to write. And I found it challenging. Like, I found it a challenge to kind of to slow the time down.
Mm. Well, speaking of moving from one time frame to the next, one of the things I noticed in your book and that I liked very much was that you do that. You cut a scene and go to the next scene, even if it's the next day or the next week. You don't spend a lot of, you know, well, and then she walked down the stairs
right.
and put on her. Talk about that, because it's the transitions worked seamlessly.
Yeah, I don't like writing segues. And actually, there's a writer named Amy Krauss-Rosenthal. She has mm-hmm. a really wonderful book called An Encyclopedia of an Ordinary Life. And it's just little bits from her life. And she says in there, I cannot write a segue. And I just love that part of the book, because I'm not, I don't like doing that. I like to just go, okay, here's the next scene. This is important. This is important. I don't like to go in a week later. One of the things that help, you know, one of the reasons that I have to say, if you find the book seamless, credit for that has to go to Rachel Clayman, my editor, because she did help me quite a bit in learning how to go from one scene to the next and keep the reader knowing where we are in time and space. And I think, you know, she's my first editor because this is my first book, but I had a remarkable experience working with her. She really helped me to get those transitions in there.
Mm. Yeah, it works. It does work remarkably. We are at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any advice for the writers who are listening.
Well, one thing I would give to memoir writers is, you know, don't listen to a lot of the media that's out there right now. Like, the media always writes these stories about, well, you know, there's all these memoirists out there, and do we really need all these people's stories? Or else, you know, they get really focused on, is this memoir true? And I find working with writing students who are working on memoir, both of those public kind of recycled arguments that are constantly in the news are quite debilitating to them. And I would just say, you know, really push all that aside and remember that your work is to commemorate your life, and that if you're a writer, you're drawn to do that on the page with words, and that you have a right to do that, and that you need to do that. And whatever, you know, is being said out in the press about memoir, just try to let that go and focus on the craft of writing.
Mm. Yeah, good one, because the marketplace is in our heads a bit too much.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to, you know, it's hard because you do want to become a published writer. I mean, you don't, you know, if we didn't, we would just write journals. And, you know, we read about, you know, what people think about memoir and, you know, is it an important form? And there's a weird dichotomy in our culture, because memoirs, you know, more popular than ever. It's a form that people are buying, that they're enjoying, that is touching them. And yet, in, like, I have to say, the New York Times, like, every couple of months, they'll write, there'll be an article that has this real anti-memoir slant. There'll be, you know, terms like navel-gazing are very popular. And it's just an odd thing. It makes it kind of a challenge to write memoir.
Mm. Thank you again so much for being on the show. It's been a delight.
Well, it's wonderful. Thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about my book, Barbara.
You're welcome. That was Theo, Pauline Nestor. Her book is How to Sleep Alone in a King-Size Bed, a wonderful memoir published by Crown. She has a website as well, and if you just put in her name, You'll find her website. Lots of good stuff there. It's time to go. If you want to know more about Writers on Writing, you can go to my website, which is at penonfire.com. You can get on my weekly email list from there. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Catherine Mansfield, who said, "Better to write twaddle anything than nothing at all." Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'll talk to you next time.
Love, Peace, and Genocide, a week-long commemoration raising awareness about the Armenian Genocide through performance art. From Monday, April 25th.